Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Illinois Republican Congressman Mike Bost has only been on the job for some 6 weeks now. How's it going so far? We'll find out a little bit later in the program. But first, eating disorders. They are a big problem. They can be fatal. They primarily affect young people, most often young women, but teenage boys are also susceptible. As we approach National Eating Disorders Awareness Week next week, we'll focus today on the overall problem. Joining me in studio, Dr. Laura Huff directs the St. Louis Behavioral Health Medicine Institute. Nancy Albus is CEO at the Castlewood Treatment Center. Judy Clifford's daughter is in recovery from anorexia nervosa. David Bachman's son is in recovery from anorexia nervosa. Thank you all so much for being with us today. Nice to have you.
Thank you.
Obviously, it's an important subject, but Laura Huff, let me begin with you. Let's get a definition. It's disorders, which we're speaking of, which is plural, which means more than one.
Correct. There are several eating disorders. They are brain-based diseases. They have psychological symptoms and very serious physical symptoms. So there's a whole range of eating disorders. Often people mistakenly believe it's only people who are underweight, and you can have a severe eating disorder and certainly be malnourished and at health risk at any weight.
Is one predominant? Overweight versus the eating disorder that causes people to be so thin?
The highest prevalence of eating disorder is actually binge eating disorder, and you can be at a ideal body weight or overweight with binge eating disorder. So that is the highest number, but it's the prevalence of eating disorder is about 10-11% in their lifetime of individuals who will have this. It's 1 out of 10, and it's a very high prevalence.
Right. Nancy Albus, what do you see at your place?
Well, we are a residential treatment center, so we treat the client that has the eating disorder has affected their life so much that they're no longer able to function. So it's a higher level of care. So we treat, when you asked about the kinds of eating disorders, there's anorexia nervosa, which is what you were talking about, an individual who is significantly below an ideal body weight. Then there's the bulimia, the client who's bulimic, which is a client who uses compensatory behaviors to balance food intake. So oftentimes those clients are clients who are using purging through vomiting or laxative abuse or exercise to regulate their weight and to control their food intake. And then, as Laura mentioned, there is the binge eater. And the binge eater can be, like Laura said, of normal weight, but at various different times consumes a large amount of food, and sometimes to the point where it's actually painful. The consumption is so much that's actually painful. So the anorexic often is viewed in the is able to be seen within the culture because it is significantly below ideal body weight. Mm-hmm. And so oftentimes people think that that's, you know, the only type of eating disorder, because bulimia sometimes is more of like a silent eating disorder where people, families, friends, loved ones are unaware of the behaviors that are occurring because they're occurring not during the mealtime, you know, oftentimes in secret after meal where the client goes to the bathroom to purge or is exercising in the middle of the night in order to control and maintain. And the same to some degree with binge eating. I mean, that is also often done in secret and in so that families and friends have no idea of the eating disorder behavior that's actually occurring.
So this can happen in a household with a child, and the parents could be totally unaware of what's going on.
Absolutely.
Well, let me find out from some parents who have gone through this. Judy, what is your story?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that the parents can be totally unaware, because the theme of next week's Eating Disorders Awareness Week is I Had No Idea. Yeah. Now, our family, atypically, we knew within a matter of weeks what was going on with our daughter. We recognized the problem, got treatment for her, and within about 7 months after treatment, including a hospitalization, she seemed to be recovered and maintained a normal weight for several years. What we didn't know was that even though she was maintaining a weight because she did not want to be sent back to the hospital, she was still what I call anorexic on the inside. And right after her 16th birthday, for whatever reason, she suffered a relapse of her anorexia, and it was a mighty struggle for a number of years, and actually ended up having to be in residential treatment for over a year. Was finally able to go on and complete her college education, and is now living and working independently, and still has to work hard to maintain her control over her eating disorder, but is certainly doing much better.
Laura Huff, does one ever completely recover from this? I'm thinking as I hear the story of alcoholics who are always alcoholics, except they stop drinking.
That's a really good question, and one parents ask and clients ask. Absolutely, people can fully recover from an eating disorder, and there's very effective treatment available. It certainly depends on quite a few variables, and there's different levels of severity, and it depends on how long they've had the eating disorder, as well as co-occurring disorders such as depression, history of trauma, anxiety, and things like that all can influence recovery.
Is it fair, you alluded to this a moment ago, but is it fair to consider this and call this a mental disorder?
Yes, but it's in some ways it's unfair to call it. It's right now considered a mental disorder, but we really understand it to be brain-based. It's neurologically based. It has a very strong genetic contribution, as high as 80-85% genetic contribution. So, you know, there's psychological symptoms, behavioral symptoms, and physical symptoms of this disease. And it's certainly not a choice. And a lot of people feel very guilty because they feel that they brought it on themselves.
We'll get back to those symptoms and treatment in just a moment. But let me bring David Bachman into the conversation and get your story regarding your son.
Yes, our son was first began his what we refer to as behaviors when he was around 12 years old. And it did go unnoticed, and we did have no idea. We chalked up a lot of what we were experiencing with them as a typical fifth grader going to the sixth grade. They get stronger, they get leaner. And then we started obviously noticing significant weight loss, isolation, choice of foods, minimization of foods, and everything started to compound. And it wasn't until we were on a vacation that we really noticed severe restricting, extra time in bathrooms, excessive exercising at very non-normal times for, you know, his level of activity. And at that point, we sought the appropriate or what we began as the appropriate steps for therapy. And he went through for about a good year and a half multiple hospitalization stays, both out of state and in state as well. And now he is on a journey of recovery.
Right. Just as an aside here, does health insurance cover the, you know, talk about hospitalization for any amount of time? It's a very expensive situation.
It's very expensive and it's very taxing on families. There is hospital coverage. It doesn't seem that hospital coverage is as thorough and in parity with other illnesses. We did have many rounds with our insurer. Back to back with ensuring that, you know, he continued treatment and so forth. At the end of it, you know, there was cost out of our pocket, you know, to ensure that he received that care.
Nancy Albus, your facility is not considered a hospital per se.
No, it is not.
So how is that different from what David's son might have received in a hospital?
Well, there are the clients that need medical restoration and attention, and it sounds like David's son was in that camp. And so what we would do is we would require a client to be medically stable, so within certain lab ranges, in order to be able to facilitate treatment in a non-hospital-like setting. So ours is a home-like setting where clients are learning to portion their food themselves, cook meals themselves, to really rework the behaviors and the relationship that they have with food. And also the intense therapy component, in addition to all of the work that's with food, along with psychiatric care, nursing care, to really understand what is at the foundational need for the behaviors for the eating disorder. I think the problem with insurance companies is they want to have the behavior cease. They want there to be a period of time, a two-week window where they're no longer using the behaviors. However, the client is far from being well, and they don't necessarily want to make the investment that Judy's daughter needed to have, too, with a year-long stay in a residential treatment or in a treatment center in order to really facilitate a recovery that's going to last a long time, or to be able to have the assistance to really work through the therapeutic issues that are driving the need for the eating disorder. And so I think that's where we struggle. We as professionals in the field struggle with insurance companies and allowing the client to really have the time in treatment to really be able to work through those issues in order to sustain recovery. And I think that's what MOEDA is, the Missouri Eating Disorder Association, and the advocacy and the show and what you're doing to really to broadcast what the signs and symptoms of an eating disorder are, so that people don't have to go to Castlewood or to go to inpatient treatment, but can be treated at lower levels of care because the intervention happens earlier, and therefore it's not as complex as when it needs medical stabilization at the hospital level or at the residential level at a place like Castlewood.
What is a typical stay at Castlewood, length of stay?
We're averaging for residential care 30 days in-house in a home-like setting, and then 30 days in day treatment. And that is, I can tell you, not nearly enough. And I think both David and Judy would say that that would have only scratched the surface for what their children and loved ones really needed.
What about follow-up? If they're getting out after 30 days...
Absolutely. That is just incredibly complex, and oftentimes the insurance isn't interested in follow-up because they're hoping that David's job changes and he is no longer on that insurance in a year. So we really advocate for the patient, for the families, but it's a battle in order to get the families and the clients the length of care that they really need. I mean, you know, I think the research says that the average recovery really takes about 6 years to really cement itself. And so you need professional care like psychiatric care, seeing a nutritionist, seeing a therapist on an outpatient session, on an outpatient setting. It isn't something that we can cure at the residential level.
Judy, 6 years sound about right to you?
Oh, it's actually been a lot longer than that. Okay. I would like to say, though, that when our daughter first became ill, this was back in the early 90s, we didn't know nearly as much about proper treatment back then. And I think that the prognosis nowadays is so much more encouraging because we know what is effective, we know what works, and if the family can find the proper treatment early on and get the proper treatment for the proper amount of time, you really cut out a lot of this chronicity that happens down the road. And that's what we're trying to get the insurance companies to see in terms of coverage.
And David, just quickly, 6 years sound right to you?
I could foresee that. We're about 2+ years into it.
So your son is 14 or 15 now?
He is 14 now, yes. So I could see with his ongoing treatment, with his therapists and doctors and nutritionists, that he still has a way to go to ensure he can manage, you know, his eating disorder.
Sure. Well, we want to talk about what parents and friends can do to recognize what's going on and seek that treatment. We'll do that in a moment. We're talking about eating disorders. My guests in studio, Dr. Laura Huff, director of the St. Louis Behavioral Health Medicine Institute. Nancy Albus is CEO at the Castlewood Treatment Center. Judy Clifford is the mother of a daughter who is in recovery from anorexia nervosa, and David Bachman's son is also in recovery from anorexia nervosa. We'll be back to continue the conversation. If you'd like to get into it, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK, or send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll also take a tweet at STL on Air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our discussion of eating disorders with Laura Huff, Nancy Albus, Judy Clifford, and David Bachman. Laura, back to you with regard to the symptoms that we've talked about. there's a secrecy issue here. You've got to see something mm-hmm. in order to seek the treatment. What do you look for?
Well, so for parents, you know, they're going to look for isolating behavior and mood changes. And sometimes it's very confusing because parents think this is just part of adolescence. But typically you're seeing some personality changes. There's really a lot more time spent alone. And this is not by any means pleasant time. They're isolating from not just parents, but friends. They're avoiding eating. And it's easy to miss because we're not having family meals. Often we're very busy. So kids can tell their parents, I ate at school. I ate, you know, after practice. So parents aren't always seeing what kids are eating. It helps to have some regular family meals so that you really can observe your child eating and really take seriously the mood changes that you might be seeing. You may see weight changes, you may not. You may see food missing. You may find evidence of, certainly purging or hoarding in kids' rooms and things like that. Again, though, a lot of times parents aren't so quick to pick up on this because they may be very much supporting their child who might be very high achieving and very competitive in sports. And so initially it's masked as just being a high achiever and being very diligent and dedicated to, say, for example, their sports.
The early detection is critical.
Very critical. So we really want to stress that with early detection and aggressive treatment, we have the best prognosis, the most favorable outcomes. And so especially in teens, it is so important to go ahead, interrupt life, interrupt school and sports to get the treatment you need. You know, 6 and 7 years isn't at high levels of care, and it's just the time to really support their recovery and learning adaptive coping skills, dealing with what might be behind it. But it can prevent really a lifetime of suffering. And many of the individuals that I work with are women and men at old who are at different stages of their life who've been struggling with this for many years.
And I think early intervention is such an important thing because if it's made aware, if the parent or the loved one is made aware that there's a problem, oftentimes counseling 2 days a week with the assistance of a dietitian can really have a very positive, impactful change. So, that's what we're here for, to really shine the light on helping parents and loved ones in schools really mm-hmm. look for these behaviors, because only 1 in 10 really will seek treatment for their eating disorder.
Are you seeing more young men than previously was the case?
Great question, and yes. Yeah. And probably that is a group of clients that often struggle to seek treatment. So there's probably a lot more men that, because of shame and the perception of it being a female disease, it goes hidden for longer. And we are seeing more and more men seek treatment because, just like with women, the focus on the body and the utilization of either the refusal or the consumption of food as the coping mechanism to deal with things.
We've been talking about young people primarily. Is this something that presents in young people, or can it manifest itself as people get older?
Absolutely. Right. It can manifest itself at any stage in the lifespan, although very often individuals may have had an eating disorder in their past, maybe subclinical symptoms, and then maybe because of other stressors in life, they become more symptomatic. And that is through not just middle age, but late life. You can have individuals with active eating disorder symptoms such as purging, in very high numbers, actually, compared to what one might expect.
Is there a specific cause? I mean, we've talked a little bit about this, but I'm thinking of the media. I'm thinking of peer pressure. I'm thinking of other things that might come into play.
Probably all of the above. Uh-huh. Certainly, we know there's a role in society of this thin ideal, that we overvalue being thin. And when you buy into that, it can really lead to aggressive dieting, which is a leading behavior that can cause eating disorders. But it's very complex in terms of the causes and the purposes of the eating disorder.
David, could you put your finger on anything, any of those things?
I would concur with a point Laura made as it relates to body image. Staying fit for young males. And we saw that with our son, a very avid soccer player. He gravitated to diving. Diving necessitated, in his mind, a certain weight limit, which then became a restriction for him, and then really fed and fueled his eating disorder.
Judy Clifford, how about you? Could you point to any one thing?
Well, actually, I think there were a whole constellation of things. My daughter was involved in gymnastics from a young age and got to the point where she could no longer be competitive because she simply had the wrong body type. But what we like to say is that genetics loads the gun and culture pulls the trigger. And it doesn't necessarily have to be about body image. It can just be about achieving, being perfectionistic, mm-hmm. personality traits that can turn against you.
When you say genetics loads the gun, what do you mean by that?
Well, people can have certain vulnerabilities, and it usually is in the form of certain personality traits, such as perfectionism, that can make you vulnerable, and certain pressures or triggers can precipitate the onset of symptoms.
Did you want to add to that, Laura?
I completely agree. Yeah. And one of the leading, if we want to think about traits, would be perfectionism. This is often missed because these are your good kids. They're doing
all
the right things.
Not a bad trait. It's not a bad trait.
Many parents think it's positive. My daughter, for example, when she was just in first grade, she would come home from school, would not allow herself an after-school snack until she had finished all of her homework. Mm. We thought this was a good thing. We didn't know this was a personality trait that was going to get her into trouble later.
Let's take a couple of phone calls. We'll start with Ryan calling from Webster Groves. Ryan, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you? My name is Ryan, and I am actually in male with an eating disorder. I struggle with bulimia, and I've taken a semester off from my school, Wash U, to focus on getting better. And I can say that it is one of the key personality traits that I have is perfectionism. That's been the way since I was in grade school, and I think that personality trait for me loaded the gun. And throughout high school, I swam on the swim team, and I became a little chubby, just overeating. And I was teased. I was called by my friends. I was called Pooh Bear, and though those things didn't consciously hurt me at the time, I think subconsciously they got to me, and I was seeing my other swimmer friends very in shape, and I developed anorexia. I went to a treatment facility between my junior and senior year of high school, and I went with the motions. I didn't really focus on the getting better. I pretty much was just saying, this is the way I am. I'm perfectionistic. I'm going to want to make my body this way. And I relapsed last year in a freshman at college at Wash U. And this past fall, it got so bad that my parents and pushed me and all my family pushed me to go into residential treatment because it was so bad.
How is that going for you, Ryan?
It's going great so far. I mean, I think I was hesitant at first to go into treatment. I did not want to go to treatment. Academics are very important to me. Perfect academics are very important to me. I'm still working on that perfectionism. I go to Wash U on a full scholarship. These academic scholarship. These many people who develop eating disorders focus on pleasing themselves and others, and one of the things they can do that is to make their bodies perfect. That's one of the final things that they can control.
Ryan, I'd like to get some reaction to the things that you've said. Thank you so much for the call, and good luck to you
as you go through this
process. Laura, you're nodding in the affirmation as you listen to him. I gather this is a relatively typical story.
Yes, and it took so much courage for him to share this story with us and to give up his first semester, going to college and to take time off is so hard to do because there often is a lot of pressure to put academics first before your health.
Nancy, what about the relapse? I mean, obviously this happens. I think perhaps it's people at this table are familiar with that. Is it a frequent occurrence?
It is a frequent occurrence. Yeah. I mean, we think of recovery on a rather lengthy continuum. What we hope is that there are lapses and not relapses. Recovery is not a perfect thing. Like I said, there isn't a point early in treatment where the therapeutic process feels complete enough, and therefore the triggers and the issues with food and the emotional issues are complete enough where it's no longer a daily struggle. You hope that the client gains other coping mechanisms to utilize when those struggles come up, and not to use food as that method of coping mechanisms. And what you hope is that the client begins to recognize the signs and the signals for when they need to step back, take a pause, focus on what's coming up for them internally, and really protect what they have achieved in terms of their recovery and continue to work on it. We often say that the work happens in layers. And so a client does, initially in recovery, a certain component of that layered process, and then they do and go out in life. And oftentimes there's another therapeutic layer that needs to be attended to in order to really secure that recovery. I think, the other point that I want to make is oftentimes parents feel like they have done something wrong. And so they want to keep it hidden and dealt with within the family. And I think the importance of what that young man's story echoed is it's never one thing. It's never the family that creates the eating disorder. As you've all heard in these stories today, they're incredibly complex, and there's many things that create this perfect storm that results in someone struggling from an eating disorder.
Judy, were you a guilt trip for you?
Actually, no, but we were lucky because we had some prior knowledge based on other experiences. But it is true, many parents do start to blame themselves.
David?
We did on certain levels. It was more on how could we miss something like this? How could we, not catch the signs and the behaviors?
Sure. Let's take another call. Shannon joins us from Belleville. Shannon, go ahead.
Hi, Don. I just have a quick comment and a quick question. First, I would recommend that any parents struggling with their children's eating disorders look into the Maudsley approach. Mm-hmm. It's a way of incorporating parents into the therapeutic approach, and it's really fascinating. Harriet Brown has a great book on it. My question is, what do the experts think about the war on fat, the war on obesity affecting eating disorders? It seems like kids are terrified of being fat now because of this focus on obesity. Do they believe that this has had an impact on eating disorders, or do they think that there's been a negative impact from it?
Thanks for the call, Shannon. Who'd like to take that? Laura, would you?
Research does show that obesity problems, programs in our school and kind of this war on obesity is a contributor to the development of eating disorders. Dieting is actually in children contributes to weight gain. So we're still trying to figure out this equation, how to just trust their body and trust food. And there just isn't very good social learning right now and modeling around this. So, and I do want to underscore that family-based treatment, the Maudsley method, is very effective treatment. It empowers the family, the parents, and parents are actively involved in the best resource for recovering their child.
We're going to have to wrap this up, I'm afraid. But Judy, I want to come back to you because you can tell us about something we can look for next week to kind of remind us of this conversation today.
Yes. Next week, of course, is National Eating Disorders Awareness Week. And all around the country, different buildings are being lit up in the colors of the National Eating Disorders Association, which are green and blue. If you're in New York, you'll see the Empire State Building lit up. And here in St. Louis, the planetarium is going to be lit in our Missouri Eating Disorders Association colors. So keep an eye out for that.
All right. And that's what that's all about, folks. If you see those colors, that's what it's all about. I want to thank you all so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Judy Clifford, thank you. Nancy Albus, yes. Thank you. Laura Huff, thank you. And David Bachman, thank you. Good luck to you with your kids, by the way. I know they're well along for the most part, but let's keep our fingers crossed for them. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll come back in just a moment with Illinois Congressman Mike Bost. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.